Chapter 4. Morocco. Nina brought the camera up to her face mask, framed the foundation wall in the viewfinder, and squeezed the shutter release on the waterproof housing. The motor drive whirred softly. The last shot she needed for the photo mosaic. Finally. With a quick, sharp expulsion of air, she cleared the water from her snorkel. Using an easy side-stroke, she swam toward the stairs. Mapping the bottom single-handed had been tedious. She first laid out a number of small, spherical plastic buoys in a tic-tac-toe pattern as a guide. Then it was swim, stop, shoot. Again and again. She carried a metal blueprint of the port in her head. Had the water miraculously receded, she could have strolled blindfolded on the old quay and not bumped into a wall or fallen into a piscina or kothan. The task of assembling dozens of photos into a composite map would be formidable. She had tried to match the photos using the buoys coupled with distinctive bottom landmarks. A crude system at best, but fine for now. Nina wasn't looking for scientific precision. She wanted a dramatic package that would have the tight-fisted bean counters who controlled expeditionary money dreaming of front-page headlines in USA Today and feature stories in Time and on Unsolved Mysteries. She hoisted herself onto the steps and got out of her dive gear. As she toweled her body dry, she looked out over the lagoon and decided to put off the buoy removal until the morning. She'd be as wrinkled as a white raisin if she spent any more time in the water. Minutes later, she was loping along the path to the camp, with a discernible jauntiness in her stride. There was good reason to be pleased. She had accomplished an incredible amount of work in a short time. People were still working on the excavation, and the camp was deserted. Well, almost. As she neared the tents, she saw Gonzalez at the periphery of the campsite, talking to someone in a jeep. As she approached, the jeep drove off before she got a look at the driver's face. "Who was that?" she said, watching the dust cloud thrown out by the departing vehicle. The automatic Gonzalez smile clicked on as if somebody had pressed a switch.
"Someone who was lost. I gave him directions."
Lost? What was Gonzalez talking about? This wasn't like taking a wrong turn off a freeway. The camp was miles from anywhere or anything. It was lonely country with nothing to attract anyone except a bunch of crazy bone diggers.
"You'd have to want to get lost out here."
When she first saw the man in the jeep, she thought he might have been called in by Fizel. So while she didn't buy the explanation, she was relieved to hear it. At breakfast, Dr. Fizel had announced the expected arrival of Moroccan divers within a few days. He strongly advised Nina to curtail her explorations so as not to disturb the site. Nina leaned over the table and stuck her chin right in his face.
"A camera was hardly intrusive," she said quietly, but with such cold fury in her gray eyes that Dr. Knox complained after breakfast that icicles had formed on his mustache. Fizel Priscilli reminded everyone of his responsibility to his cousin the king, then retreated into an unconvincing apology about only wanting to preserve the integrity of the site. Nina had to admit she was being somewhat devious herself. She was removing artifacts from the site, a big no-no, and had told neither Fizel nor Knox. Nor was Fizel aware that her preliminary findings were sent winging off to UPenn's cyber vault. The Stonehead still remained her secret as well. She rationalized her uncharacteristic behavior. Drastic times call for drastic measures. Kasim, Fizel's tea-boy, gave her a friendly wave. Dumb as a fence post, but not a bad kid when you got to know him. Savoring the tranquility, Nina went into her tent, slipped out of her bathing suit and into dry clothes. She switched on her computer and saw the email icon blinking. The message was from Dr. Eleanor Sanford, the faculty member at UPenn to whom she had directed her computer transmission. Sandy Sanford and Nina had been undergraduate classmates before branching into their own specialties. Sandy went into Mesoamerican studies, explaining that her preferences had more to do with cuisine than with cultures. She preferred burritos to couscous. Her culinary tastes might be open to question, but her scholarship was not. She had just been appointed a faculty curator at the university's museum. Nina scrolled down her message. "Congratulations, Nina. You don't have to bring me Hannibal's head to convince me you've hit a Phoenician port. Wish I could show you the fabulous stuff you transmitted to the Jurassic set here in the hidebound halls of archaeological academia. Could start another Punic War. But I'll abide by your wishes to keep things quiet. What does El Grando Professoro think? Can't wait to see you. Stay dry. Love, Sandy." There was more. "P.S. Resketch of the Big Stone Head. Some kind of joke, right? I get it. You're just testing me. Check your fax line." Nina called up her fax function. A photo of a stone face appeared on the screen. At first, she thought it was the carving in the lagoon. But next to it, for comparison, was the sketch she had sent. She stared at the screen. The sculptures were identical. She scrolled some more. Other stone heads came into view. They all could have been carved by the same sculptor. Except for slight details, primarily in their headgear, they shared the same brooding stare, broad nose, and impassive fleshy lips. Below the pictures was another note from Sandy. "Hello again. Welcome to one of the most enduring of all Mesoamerican mysteries. In 1938, the National Geographic Society and the Smithsonian sent an expedition to Mexico to investigate reports of giant basalt heads buried up to their eyebrows. They found 11 African-type rock figures like this at 3 sites in and around La Venta, sacred center of Olmec culture, 18 miles from the Gulf of Mexico, 6 to 9 feet high, up to 40 tons each. Not bad considering the quarry site was 10 miles away, and they were carried overland without the use of wheel or draft animals. All had that funny helmet that makes them look like they belong in the NFL. Dating figures at 800 to 700 BC. Say, what's a nice girl like you doing messing around in Meso? Nina typed out a quick reply. "Thanks for info. Most interesting. Due home next week. We'll fill you in. Smiley face. Love, Nina." She hit the send key, turned the laptop off, and sat back in her chair, stunned. A Mexican Olmec head. "Calm down, lady. Go over the facts. The figure she found had African characteristics. Big deal. This is Africa, after all." Of course, that didn't explain the match with the Mexican figures thousands of miles away. A couple of possibilities could explain the similarities. The La Venta figures might have been carved in Africa and transported to Mexico. Unlikely. Not at 40 tons apiece. The alternative theory wasn't much better. That a La Venta figure was carved in Mexico and transported to Africa. With either scenario, there was still the problem with the dating. The heads were carved hundreds of years before Columbus sailed the ocean blue. "Ouch," Nina thought. "I'm thinking like a diffusionist." She looked over her shoulder as if someone were eavesdropping on her thoughts. Admitting to an open mind on diffusionism was a one-way ticket to oblivion for a mainstream archaeologist. Diffusionists believe cultures didn't evolve in isolation, that they diffused from one place to another. The similarities between the old and new worlds had always intrigued Nina. The UFO and Atlantis enthusiasts muddied up the waters, suggesting that the pyramids and Nazca lines were the products of aliens from outer space or beings from lost continents. A female diffusionist was a double loser in this business. She had enough problems just being a woman in a man's world. The diffusionist theory had always faced a major hurdle: the absence of scientifically verified evidence that would prove contact between one hemisphere and another before Columbus. People could yak all they wanted about how Egyptian pyramids and Cambodian temples and Mexican mounds resembled one another, but nobody had discovered the artifact to connect them. Until now. And in a Phoenician port. Oh, Christ! This was going to stir up one hell of a mess. It could be the biggest discovery since King Tut's tomb. The archaeological establishment would be turned topsy-turvy. The thing in the lagoon proved a link existed between the old world and the new, 2,000 years before Christopher Columbus conned the Spanish royals out of three ships. Enough! Nina jammed on her mental brakes before she went over the precipice. She needed to think this through with a clear head. She swatted a couple of flies and lay down on the cot. She tried to put all thoughts out of her mind and concentrate on her breathing. The next thing she knew, she was being awakened by the dinner bell. Yawning and rubbing her eyes, she stumbled outside. A magnificent purple and gold sunset was in the making. She walked to the mess tent and sat at the opposite end of the table from Fissel, who was holding court. The same old blah-blah. She tuned him out and enjoyed a chat with the Iowa couple. Excusing herself before dessert, she went back to her tent and plunked down in front of her laptop. Working late into the night, Nina typed up a summary to go with her mosaic photos. By the time she quit, the camp had settled down for the evening. She put on a flannel nightie, congratulating herself for her prescience in packing it. Days were hot and dry, but at night a cool breeze came in off the ocean. She slipped under her blanket and lay there listening to the laughter and Arabic conversation as the mess crew cleaned up after dinner. Before long the voices were silent and the camp was asleep. Except for Nina. She lay on the cot wishing she hadn't taken a nap. Sandy's facts had wound her up as well. She tossed and turned, finally falling into a light slumber, only to be awakened by the sharp crackling of the fire. Her eyes blinked open, and she stared into space. Sleep wasn't meant to be. Wide awake once more, Nina wrapped the blanket around her shoulders like a Navajo, pulled on her Teva sandals, and slipped outside. A branch of burning olive tree exploded in little red spark showers on the smoky fire. The only other illumination was from propane-powered lanterns hung outside the tents, in case somebody felt the call of nature during the night. Nina looked up at the black sky. The crystal air was so clear that it seemed she could see distant nebulae with her naked eye. Impulsively, Nina grabbed a flashlight from her knapsack and set off toward the lagoon. The tombs gleamed like pewter in the light of the half-moon. Coming to the staircase, she sat down on the top step and gazed out at the moonglade reflection on the lagoon. Yellow pinpoints glowed on the ocean. The Numa ship with the turquoise hull must still be offshore. She took a deep breath. The night smelled of stagnant water, rotting vegetation, marsh, and incredible age. She closed her eyes and listened. In her imagination, clicking reeds became the slap of hide sails against wooden masts, and frog snorts the grunts of breechcloth-clad sailors hoisting amphorae filled with wine and oil. Before long, slivers of cold air penetrated the blanket. She shivered, realizing she had lost track of time. With a parting glance at the still lagoon, she started back. As she crested the ridge of dunes, a strange noise came from the camp. It sounded like a bird or animal crying out under the attack of a hunting predator. She heard it again. This was no bird or animal. It was human. Someone in terrible fear or pain. She picked up her pace to a trot, emerging from the dunes where she could see the camp. It was like a scene out of Dante, where faceless demons herd new arrivals to their hellish punishment. Expedition members in their night clothes were being prodded and pushed by gun-carrying figures dressed in black. The Iowa couple came into view. The woman stumbled and fell. An intruder grabbed her long white hair, and she was dragged along the ground screaming in terror. Her husband tried to intervene only to be clubbed to the ground, where he lay bloodied and unmoving. Still in his flannel pajamas, Professor Knox burst from his tent and looked around. Nina was close enough to see the expression on his face. He appeared more bewildered than frightened. Dr. Fizel's unmistakably rotund form appeared, and someone pushed him into Knox. Fizel shouted defiantly, although Nina couldn't hear what he said against the growing background of cries and yells. Most of the expedition people were outside now, crowded into a terrified group. Nina caught a glimpse of the drivers and cook. Gonzalez must have been with the others, but she couldn't see him. The assailants stopped their brutal attack and moved back from the huddled assembly. Knox had regained his dignity and stood with head high. He seemed frozen in stone. His face looked 1,000 years old. Fizel saw what was coming. He shouted in Arabic, but his words were lost in the ugly chatter of gunfire. The hail of bullets mowed Fizel and the others down like a scythe blade through grass. Incredibly, despite the intensity of the killing fire, pitiful moans came from the pile of bodies. Any hope Nina had of survivors vanished when two intruders stepped over the carnage. 7 shots rang out a few seconds apart. The groaning stopped. The only sound was the faint crackle of the wood fire. Nina could hardly breathe. Her mouth felt as if it were full of sawdust. Her heart hammered madly. Her dinner rose in her throat, and she gagged as she fought her urge to vomit. She wanted to run. It was only a matter of time before the killer saw her standing at the edge of the clearing. Yet she was rooted to the spot, too scared to save her own life. A figure broke from the shadows behind a tent and ran in her direction. Kasim. He must have been outside when the killer struck. The killers saw him trying to escape and lifted their weapons. They held their fire when one of their number dashed in pursuit of the T-boy. Mad with fear, Kasim ran directly toward Nina without seeing her. He would have bowled her over if he hadn't tripped on a root and fallen. He tried to scramble to his feet, but his assailant was on him quicker than a falcon on a rabbit. He reached under Kasim's chin and jerked the boy's head back. Light glinted on cold steel. Like someone cutting a pineapple, he drew the knife across the boy's throat in a swift, slashing motion. Kasim's scream died in a wet gargle as his lungs filled and he drowned in his own blood. His murderous deed accomplished, the killer stood and saw Nina. He was dressed entirely in black. A turban was wrapped around his head, covering everything except eyes that burned with a murderous hate. They widened as they saw Nina, then narrowed just before he lunged, the bloodied knife held high above his head. Nina yanked the heavy blanket from her shoulders, and wielding it in 2 hands like a great woolen club, she whipped it across the attacker's face. He hesitated and put his left arm up to ward off the blow, not expecting resistance from this helpless victim. Nina brought the blanket down like a hood over the killer's head, and while he was temporarily blinded, drove her knee into his crotch. "Ay!" The scream told her she was on target. She did it again with every intention of driving her knee to his chin. She must have nearly succeeded because he crashed to the ground and writhed in pain. The other black-clad figures saw their comrade fall and started toward Nina. But the delay gave her an advantage. She bolted like a startled deer, and, long legs racing, feet pounding the ground, outdistanced her pursuers. She could hear shouts behind her.
La mujer! La mujer!
A sandal flew off, and she kicked the other away. Barefoot now, she was through the dune ridge descending the gradual slope to the water. The rise would hide her for a moment. As she sprinted toward the lagoon, her bare foot came down on a piece of wood or sharp stone. A dagger of pain stabbed the tender flesh. She went down on one knee for a second, bit her lip until it bled, stifling the urge to yelp, then was up in a limping run. As she ran past the darkened tombs, she thought of hiding inside, but quickly discarded the idea as too obvious. She'd be trapped if the killers found her. She decided instead to run along the shore and backtrack on her pursuers. That plan was shredded by the flashlight beams that lanced the darkness behind her. Her pursuers had anticipated her move. Taking their time, they spread out along the dune ridge to cut off her flanks and catch her in a classic pincers movement. She ran straight to the lagoon. Seconds later, she was standing at the top of the stairway. The killers were closing in on all sides. It was only a matter of seconds before they caught up with her. Nina's brain worked feverishly. She could dive off the steps and swim underwater, but it would only delay the inevitable. When she came up for air, the killers would spray the lagoon until their bullets found her. She had to stay submerged until she was safely out of range. Impossible! No way! Fool! Of course there's a way! She set off along the rocky shore. Her darting eyes probed the water, searching in the moonlight. She saw the faint gray splotch of a marker buoy. Lights seemed to be coming from every direction. Soon she'd be caught in the closing net. Not this fish, she vowed. Gathering her strong legs beneath her like springs, Nina leaped off the rocks, her arms reaching straight out. She hit the water in a distance-covering, shallow racing dive and swam for the marker buoy with quick, hard strokes. The buoy flared into orange brilliance as a light from shore found its reflective surface. The water all around her was covered with shimmering blobs. A few strokes, and she was at the buoy. A fusillade opened up, and the lagoon surface erupted in miniature geysers off to her right side. No time to build up her air supply. She filled her lungs in a frantic gulp, and her supple body jackknifed in a quick surface dive. Directly under the marker, faintly illuminated by the glow of lights from above, was the stone arch. She wriggled under the arch, reached out until she felt a hard vertical edge, and pulled herself into the lightless bowels of the tunnel. As she swam, her fingers brushed the smooth wall like a crude, tactile sonar. Making it to the end of the tunnel was a long shot without air and fins. But even if this damned hole became her tomb, at least she'd have the satisfaction of knowing her pursuers would never learn her fate. She slowed slightly, trying to keep a steady, even pace. Panic would steal oxygen and energy. She swam deeper. The wall became rough to the touch. She was in the cave. The going would be trickier here. She slowed even more to navigate the twists and turns. Went down a blind alley and had to back out. It felt like hours since she had taken a breath. Her lungs pressed against her ribs as if her chest were going to explode. How long could she hold her breath? A minute? Two? Maybe, if she'd had a chance to hyperventilate and build up capacity. God, how much farther? Her head slammed into a hard surface. She was sure she felt the plates in her skull shift. She cried out instinctively and lost more air. Damn. She'd forgotten about the pile of rubble. She groped over the top of the debris and squeezed her way through the opening. She was past the halfway mark. The wall became smooth again. Good. She was back in the man-made tunnel. Only a few dozen meters. Her lungs were on fire. She let out a small breath as if that would relieve the pressure and started making sounds like a pigeon. God, she didn't want to drown. Not here. She kicked desperately with no attempt to conserve energy. The lack of oxygen made her dizzy. Next, she'd start to black out and swallow water. A painful, excruciating death. Nina stubbornly resisted taking that first fatal breath. She groped for the wall. Nothing. Then felt for the ceiling. Again nothing. Wait! She was out of the tunnel. She arched her body upward, kicked frantically, and broke the surface, where she sucked in great gulps of air. In time, her breathing became almost normal again. She treaded water, looking toward shore, where lights moved like fireflies. Then she struck off around the tip of the promontory and swam parallel to the beach. When she could swim no more, she angled in toward land. Weeds brushed her feet, and her toes felt the cool, mucky bottom. She crawled onto the sand, but rested only a few minutes before she got to her feet and walked along the beach. She came to the old riverbed, followed the wadi inland a few hundred meters, then climbed the banking and walked across the dunes until she could go no farther. She crawled into a thicket of high grass and lay down. The horror of the massacre began to play back in her mind. Dr. Knox, Fizel, Kasim, all dead. Why? Who were those men? Why were they after her? Bandits who thought the expedition had discovered treasure? No, the concentrated fury of the attack was too organized for bandits. It was meant to be a massacre. Shivering with the cold, Nina removed her flannel nightie, wrung the water from it, and put it back on over her camisole top and underwear. The wet fabric raised goosebumps the size of eggs. She broke off clumps of grass and stuffed them under the nightie until she looked like a scarecrow. The primitive insulation was scratchy, but it helped keep the cold air out. The shivering subsided somewhat, and before long she fell asleep. Near dawn, she was awakened by a murmur of voices coming from the direction of the riverbed. Maybe help had arrived, and they were searching for her. She held her breath and listened. Spanish. Without a second's delay, she slithered into the tall beach grass like a frightened salamander.